something is off, and it's been off long enough now where you've probably stopped noticing it. So you're standing somewhere, let's say a park or a restaurant, or I don't know, let's say you're standing in the kitchen of someone you love, and you have this faint sensation that you're watching yourself be there. Like the moment is happening just slightly behind glass. So technically you're present. You can feel the chair, you know, what city you're in. And honestly, some days that's about as good as it gets. I notice this usually in small, stupid ways, I guess. Someone tells me something genuinely horrible, like a death or a diagnosis or something, and I catch myself having the right facial expression before I've actually felt anything. And yeah, it's strange. It's like the feeling has to load up or something. And there's this a half second delay between the world and me. And I don't think that's just me being a idiosyncratic weirdo, though I'll admit the sample size is rather limited there. So I've noticed that there's this odd collective fog that's settled in that you can feel, you sense this in conversations now. I mean, have you noticed how people talk about catastrophic things now, like they used to talk about the weather? And, you know, this is either emotional maturity or the early stages of something a clinician would find very interesting. And this, the effect of this, it's flat. The reactions basically sound calibrated. And everyone seems to be performing like a somewhat muted version of themselves. And nobody's calling it out. Because, well, that would require the kind of energy that nobody really has anymore. I get the impression that we've collectively agreed, without any meetings, to not make it weird. That's the vibe I'm getting now. And I wouldn't call this depression, exactly. Depression has like a texture to it, like a weight. This is more like the absence of texture. It's like biting into something that should have a taste and then just getting mostly nothing. So, cardboard. And this isn't a new feeling. That's the part I think that's worth sitting with. So there's this sense that things don't quite feel real anymore. And experiences are somehow like thinner than they used to be. And this has become like the ambient drone of daily life in a lot of people. It's become normal. So we've basically normalized mild dissociation from our lives. And you know, we call it being busy or being tired or just, I guess, being a functional adult in the current era. Now, the question I keep coming back to is whether something is actually changing in us or in the nature of reality as we're experiencing it, or whether this is just what it feels like when a civilization starts losing its grip. Now, something tells me it's probably both. Things are rarely just one thing. All right, so before we get into the philosophy, and the neuroscience and whatever else, there's a guy definitely worth mentioning, a writer. This is a writer who spent his entire career asking the question, what is real? And he was asking this long before that question was considered serious or the kind of thing you'd get a TED talk out of. So enter Philip K. Dick, or as I will call him here, PKD. So he was writing what I would say was philosophy, but he was hiding it in pulp science fiction from the 1950s through the 1970s and early 1980s, I guess, too. He was frequently broke, occasionally unhinged, and I would say about a good 30 years ahead of his time. And he was probably the kind of guy that you wouldn't want to be stuck in an elevator with, but probably you should have listened to him if you were. So his books kept returning to the same basic situation, which is that there's an ordinary person who is slowly realizing that the reality around them is constructed or, I guess, manufactured. And that what they've been experiencing as solid and trustworthy is actually turning out to be a very convincing, I guess, stage set. Now, if you're at all familiar with Blade Runner, Total Recall, A Scanner Darkly, a Minority Report, no, I'm yeah, Minority Report, The Man in the High Castle. These were all original stories by PKD. I mean, the details changed, but the sense of dread was always there. It had that general, this general creeping suspicion that the floor isn't quite as solid as you think. Yeah. I mean, if you've read his stuff, you get the gist here. So people used to call this kind of writing like paranoid fiction, which to me just translates to that they just weren't ready for this kind of stuff. So PKD had a definition of reality that I used to think about a lot more than I probably should have. Many years ago, I did an independent study in metaphysics in college, and he was definitely a fun influence on that. So PKD once stated that reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. Simple enough, right? Except I would say that lately that definition feels like a question with a slow leak in it, because a lot of things that used to not go away when you stop believing in them, like institutions or consensus, the general sense that there's a shared world out there, these things seem to be going away gradually and then all at once. So P.K. Dick was considered in his time a fringe figure. So you could say that he was interesting in the way that I suppose slightly unhinged people are interesting from, so he was interesting from a comfortable distance. Let's just put it that way. But I would argue that he was just doing early field work, and unfortunately, he wasn't paid very well for it. And sadly, he died just before Blade Runner was released in 1982. Yes, another brilliant artist who did not live to see the fruits of his labors. So, okay. There's a French philosopher named Jean Baudrillard who, in 1981, essentially wrote a user manual for a world that wouldn't exist for probably another 20 years or so. So his idea was this. At some point, the copy of a thing becomes or became more real than the thing itself. And he called this hyperreality. So the simulation doesn't just represent reality. It replaces it. And once that happens, you can't go back to the original because the original starts to feel fake by comparison. So the example that he used was maps. If you made a map detailed enough, that like every street, every blade of grass, eventually people would relate to the map instead of the actual territory. And the territory would then become the inconvenient version. We did that, just not with maps. So, well, let's take food, for example. The burger in the advertisement, it's perfectly lit, architecturally assembled. It's glistening in a way that no actual burger has ever glistened. And that image is now what a burger is supposed to look like. The real burger, on the other hand, over there sitting in its wrapper looking sad and deflated, is a disappointment by comparison. So it's the simulation that sets the standard, right? The actual thing is just a rough draft. And this is basically the society we live in now. So let's scale that up to travel, relationships. Let's scale it up to what a meaningful life is supposed to look like. So let's say you're at some genuinely beautiful place. I don't know, a canyon, a coastline by the ocean, you know, somewhere that took some real effort to get to. And the first thing your brain does is it starts composing the photo, right? It starts framing the scene. Because apparently somewhere along the way, the experience and the documentation of the experience, those things switched places. The record became the point, and the moment became the raw material. And the strange part is, you know this is happening. You can feel it happening, but you take the photo anyway. Because the alternative, just standing there, actually being somewhere with no proof, feels vaguely irresponsible, like it didn't count or something. That's not a personal failure of presence or mindfulness or whatever the hell the wellness industry is currently calling it. That is a structural shift in how experience gets organized. So what happened is the copy basically ate the original, and we were just too busy photographing it or videotaping it to notice. You know, there was a period not too long ago when most people in a given country were actually working from roughly the same set of facts. And this wasn't because everyone was smart or enlightened or I guess particularly interested in the truth. It was because the information infrastructure was actually pretty narrow. You had a few newspapers, maybe three channels, at least that's what I had growing up. You had like one anchor who told you what happened today, and he said it in a voice that made it sound like it was non-negotiable. So if you're old enough to remember Walter Cronkite, he would look into the camera and say something happened, and most of the country would think, okay, that happened. The man had a very trustworthy chin. We'll go with that. Those were simpler times. Simpler, and also apparently we all needed to hold a civilization together, which I guess says something about civilizations. The thing is, you know, it wasn't a perfect system. It had its own distortions and its own blind spots, of course. It had its own things that it discreetly decided not to mention, like entire categories of people and what was actually happening to them. But I will say this, it did produce something that in retrospect seems almost like a luxury nowadays, a shared reality, a common floor plan that enough people were standing on at the same time that you could build things on it. Facts, agreements, policies. There was a functioning sense of what was actually going on. Now that floor plan is gone now. Or not gone, I guess. But it's definitely fractured into like 300 million personalized versions, and each one is algorithmically optimized to keep you engaged. So, in other words, optimized to make you feel something, preferably outrage, because outrage is, you know, it's cheap and reliable, and of course it gets people to keep scrolling. So it turns out that the business model for destroying a shared reality is actually extremely profitable. I mean, who would have guessed it? And well, here's the part that I think gets a little uncomfortable. When people deny facts now, when they look at something documented and sourced, and they still say, no, that's not real. You know, the easy response is to call them stupid or manipulated, which, of course, is absolutely true sometimes. But the deeper thing to consider here is that facts don't exist in a vacuum. They exist inside a narrative framework that gives them meaning and therefore weight. And when that framework collapses, when there's no real shared story that facts are plugging into, then a fact becomes just another assertion. It's just another thing that someone is trying to get you to believe. So, congratulations. Now you now have the same epistemological status as a pop-up ad. So people reach for the framework that's available in these situations. This would be the one that that makes internal sense. You know, it has villains and there's patterns and it has a reason why things are the way they are. I mean, the framework might be wrong. It's usually wrong, but it's doing a job that nothing else is currently doing. We act like fact denial is a stupidity problem. Sometimes it is, of course, but it's mostly what I would call an architecture problem, meaning the building that used to hold the facts burned down and nobody's mentioned it. All right, so there's a philosopher and sociologist named Jean-François Lyotard, who argued that postmodernism essentially killed all the big stories. So what he meant was, okay, so these big stories are they're the organizing narratives that used to hold everything together. Like, for instance, progress, God, science, the nation. So Lyotard called them grand narratives, and he said that we ultimately stopped believing them. And this may sound like a philosophy seminar problem until you realize that those stories were actually doing what they were actually doing. They weren't just a bunch of decoration. They were actually the architecture of, well, they were the architecture that gave individual facts a place to live. So a fact inside a coherent story has weight. It means something. But outside of one, it's a data point. Basically floating in a room with no walls. So basically when the stories collapsed, the facts just went with them. But the vacuum, that didn't stay empty because the conspiracy theories moved in. And this doesn't happen because people are broken. It happens because most conspiracy theories, I say most, not all, most conspiracy theories are just, they're grand narratives with the serial numbers filed off. It explains everything. It has villains. It makes the chaos feel somehow intentional, which is apparently more bearable than the alternative. The alternative being that nobody's in charge and that it's all just random. So most people, if they're given the choice between a terrifying explanation or no explanation at all, they're going to take the terrifying explanation every time because at least it's something to hold on to. So there is a psychological phenomenon you may have heard of called derealization, this is when the mind creates distance from experience. So the mind makes everything feel slightly unreal, removed. Basically, it does this so it can manage something that it can't fully process. So it's protective. It's kind of like, I guess, the psyche's way of turning down the volume when the signal just gets unbearably loud. So this means that your brain, it's essentially putting itself into a do not disturb mode. Therapists, they see derealization in people who've been through sustained trauma of some kind. And I think the interesting thing is we seem to be seeing this in entire populations now. It's not just isolated people here and there anymore. And this is, you know, this is either a major diagnostic breakthrough or a billing opportunity, depending on your perspective. And if you think about what the last several years have asked people to metabolize, like we had a pandemic, we're going through institutional collapse, economic precarity, we're going through the slow administrative horror of climate change, and well, not to mention the dawning realization that most of the adults in charge were just making it up as they went. And so, you know, naturally the numbness from all of this, it starts to make a certain grim sense. Eric Fromm wrote a book in 1941 called Escape from Freedom. And his argument was that genuine freedom is terrifying. And given the option, most people will trade that freedom for the comfort of certainty. I mean, we all do this to a certain degree in our lives. Hand the wheel to someone else. Stop feeling quite so much. You know, we read it as a warning, but it turns out it was actually more a forecast. The derealization might be that impulse just scaled up. It's like a species level flinch. And I think the unsettling part here, it isn't that people are checked out. It's that checked out might actually just be the rational response, which is a terrible thing to realize, but also somehow not surprising at all, right? So here's where I think it gets genuinely strange. At some point in the last decade or so, it seems that a lot of people became aware in a real working way that their perceptions are manufactured. And that algorithms are now shaping what they see. So people are discovering that their emotional reactions are being engineered by people in offices who A/B tested the color of a button until it produced the optimal amount of anxiety. I mean, we know this. It's not some big secret, but you know, it's not as if knowing it really helps anything, because once you're aware that your sense of reality is being curated, you start second guessing everything that comes through it, and that includes yourself. So you feel something, whatever, grief, joy, outrage, and somewhere in the back of your head, a small auditor shows up and asks, well, is this real? Or have you just consumed enough content about this emotion to know that or what it's supposed to feel like? And of course, now, you know, AI is making this worse in a specific way, because now, you know, we're now approaching a point where any video, any image, any sound, any piece of apparent evidence could be fabricated convincingly enough to pass, which means authenticity stops being something you can verify, and then it becomes something you have to feel. And, you know, human feelings, as we've established, are currently not running at peak reliability. So in a sense, we're basically using a broken instrument to detect a moving target. I guess at some point, someone's going to bring up quantum physics in a conversation about reality. And I guess today that someone is going to be me. So I guess let's get it over with, shall we? And by the way, if you've made it this far in the video, you're a champion. So classical physics gave us a universe that behave like a very large and reliable machine. Solid objects, predictable trajectories, pretty much the kind of reality that you could set a watch to. But then quantum mechanics showed up, and it discreetly informed us that at the foundational level, reality is probabilistic. So it's observer dependent. And it also revealed that particles exist in multiple states simultaneously until the act of measurement forces them to pick one. Which I think is either a profound philosophical revelation or it's a particle having a small existential crisis. Possibly both. So the observer effect is the idea that the act of looking at something actually changes it, which sounds kind of crazy, but it's true. And this idea has, you know, it's now kind of seeped into the cultural imagination. It's seeped into the imagination in ways that I would say are, they're loosely connected to the actual science. Loosely. The people seem to invoke quantum physics the way they invoke something like karma. So confidently, but at a comfortable distance from what it actually means. But the institution that it produces, it's not entirely wrong, because at the smallest scales, the universe doesn't behave the way common sense says it should. And that at least makes the rest of the conversation feel slightly less like it's our fault. I mean, hey man, it's the universe. I think it would be dishonest to frame all of this as just pure catastrophe. Exhausting, maybe, yes. Disorienting, definitely. But purely catastrophic, I think that's a stretch. You know, consensus reality was always a construction. It just didn't feel like one because the people doing the constructing were confident enough to make it seem inevitable. And some of what's dissolving, it needed to dissolve. You know, rigid social scripts that were handed down, like heirlooms that nobody actually wanted. Economic assumptions about what a good life looks like that turned out to be mainly to mainly benefit people who were already having a pretty good life. Surprise, surprise. Hierarchies dressed up as nature. I mean, that stuff crumbling is not entirely, I wouldn't call it a tragedy. Even if the crumbling itself is ugly and occasionally features someone, you know, screaming on the internet. Now, there's also, you know, we need to consider, there's also the Eastern philosophy angle, which is either, you know, going to be deeply comforting or deeply annoying, depending on your mood or your perspective. So Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta have been saying for centuries, I guess, thousands of years, that phenomenal reality is constructed and contingent and probably not worth clinging to. But, you know, the West is finally arriving at this realization now. Though I would say we're arriving at it accidentally through, well, now through algorithmic radicalization and, you know, a global pandemic. So without any meditation practice or a monastery or really any preparation whatsoever. So what's happened to us is we've got the insight, but we just skip the part where you learn how to handle it, which does feel very on brand for us, come to think of it. Okay, so here's the problem with everyone having their own personal version of reality. I mean, it's fine, philosophically speaking. I think it's even interesting. But, you know, right up until you actually need to do something together in solidarity. Because collective action requires shared ground. I mean, democracy, climate response, public health, etc. You know, all of it runs on the basic assumption that enough people can agree on what is happening before deciding what to do about it. I mean, it's a low bar. I think it's a depressingly low bar. And we're somehow failing to clear it. You know, when reality fractures into all these personalized versions, and each one is internally consistent and algorithmically reinforced, coordinating a response to an actual shared problem becomes like next to impossible. You can't negotiate with someone who about solutions if you can't agree on whether the problem even exists. So you end up in a conversation that feels like two people describing completely different buildings that happen to be on the same dead-end street. I think the individual derealization, you know, the personal fog, the everything feels thin sensation That's uncomfortable, yes, but it's I think it's survivable. I mean, let's face it, people have gotten through worse with worse coping mechanisms. I think the civilizational version of the problem, of this problem, is that that's a different matter entirely. But a species that can't agree on what's real, they're going to have a very miserable time agreeing on anything else. Which, looking around, seems to be going exactly as well as you can imagine. All right, so I guess we kind of started this monologue with Philip K. Dick, and I guess we might as well end there. So in his books, his protagonists, you know, the ones stumbling through these constructed realities, you know, manufactured memories, worlds that turned out to be elaborate stage sets, at least they got the dramatic moment. They had their dramatic moment, you know, the seams showing and the curtain pulling back and the horror, I guess the horror of discovery, which is its own kind of clarity. Because you know what's happening. You have something to push against. But we got something different. We basically got the fog version of this. We got the slow, nobody announced anything version, where reality doesn't melodramatically reveal itself as fake. It just, in our version, it just gradually loses resolution until you're not even sure what the hell you're looking at anymore. So this version is, you know, it's less cinematic, let's say. It's a little harder to write a screenplay about, I guess. So I guess the question is, well, then what do you do with it then? Well, I think maybe there's a couple of things, and neither of them is, well, neither of them are particularly glamorous, sorry to say. I think the first thing is, you know, we have to get aggressively local. And I say this a lot in my videos, local community. The unreality tends to live in the feed, you know, the scroll, which means it has a harder time surviving in an actual room with, you know, actual people and a specific problem that needs handling. The smaller and more concrete the thing, the less the fog seems to penetrate it. Like a neighborhood, you know, a conversation that isn't being documented, a problem with a physical address. It's not a solution so much as a working radius. I think the second thing is to just get comfortable with not knowing. And I know that might sound like something stitched on a pillow, but the actual practice of it, it's less serene than that. Because basically it means sitting with the uncertainty without immediately, you know, reaching for a framework that makes it go away. So the conspiracy theory and the ideology and the, I guess, the wellness routine, all of them are really just ways of making the open question close faster than it should. And keeping the question open is going to be uncomfortable. But it's also probably closer to being honest. So Philip K. Dick died in 1982, 4 months before Blade Runner was released. So he never saw what he'd mapped become the terrain everyone was living in, which seems about right. Because it seems that, you know, prophets rarely get to watch the forecast come true. And I think the people who seem the most grounded in reality right now are mostly just people who haven't pulled the thread yet. And that's fine. The thread, it'll still be there. It always is. And this has been a long monologue, so at this point, I'm going to stop, and as I always say, thanks for listening.